Winston S. Churchill, The Second World War, Volume 2, Their Finest Hour. Between May 1940 and January 1941, the world witnessed some of the most spectacular military victories of all times. Fortunately for civilization, they were not all won by the massed might of Nazi Germany, its ally Italy, and its temporary accomplice, the Soviet Union. This period of the war was the cause of more grief and strain for my grandfather than any other, and yet, in his words, charged with a sense of history, and as uplifting as the speech Shakespeare gave to Henry V on the eve of Agincourt. If the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say this was their finest hour. Britain stood alone in combat against the mortal threat posed to Christian civilization, liberal democracy, and human decency. The audacity and brilliance of the military onslaught in the West staggered both France and Britain. The tactic of blitzkrieg, the coordinated attack by dive bombers and massed armor traveling at speed, laid bare the inadequacy of the static French defensive position known as the Maginot Line. As my grandfather observed, we had all prepared for the same war that we had fought in 1914-18. Everyone, that is, except the Germans. The consequences were almost fatal. Only by great bravery and good fortune were British and Allied troops evacuated from defeated France through Dunkirk. But the British army was now virtually without arms, and France felt obliged to take whatever terms she could get from Hitler. Britain's salvation was the Channel. However, unlike in other wars, its control no longer depended solely upon naval power, but also on our ability to control the skies. The fall of France posed my grandfather with his most painful decision of the war. In the 1930s, the French had built up their strongest fleet for generations. If those ships fell into the hands of Germany, they could be turned with devastating effect upon Britain. Despite assurances from Admiral d'Arlon that he would never allow such an eventuality to come to pass, the British government felt that it could not take any risks. The French fleet must either be put out of German reach or be rendered ineffective. Sadly, in the end, the latter course had to be taken. The British attack upon French naval forces caused much pain and soul-searching, but it had to be done. A more immediate threat to Britain came from the Luftwaffe. After the fall of France, Britain became Hitler's next objective. However, to achieve the conquest of Britain, Germany, with its vastly superior air power, had to gain control of the skies over the Channel. This they failed to do. The RAF inflicted a 2-to-1 ratio of losses in the air against the Germans. British cities suffered badly from the Blitz, and fighter pilot losses were serious, but mastery of the air remained in British hands. In the Battle of Britain, in my grandfather's words, never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. On the home front, the organization of the war effort proceeded apace. Changes were made in the government, and my grandfather continued to cultivate warm relations with President Roosevelt. The most significant outcome from that during these early months of the war was Lend-Lease, which provided Britain with immense amounts of supplies and munitions. Finally, there was the beginning of the long and bitter desert war in North Africa. At first, this was between British and Italian forces. Despite being heavily outnumbered, we went from victory to victory. The Fleet Air Arm inflicted heavy losses on the Italian fleet at its anchorage at Taranto, and in the new year of 1941, the Italian army suffered a heavy defeat at the Battle of Barani. There were still many hardships and disasters to come, but my grandfather could rightly proclaim of Britain during these months, alone, but upborne by every generous heartbeat of mankind, we had defied the tyrant in the height of his triumph.
Mm. now at last, the slowly gathered, long pent-up fury of the storm broke upon us. 4 or 5 millions of men met each other in the first shock of the most merciless of all the wars of which record has been kept. In giving an account of my stewardship and in telling the tale of the famous National Coalition Government, it is my first duty to make plain the scale and force of the contribution which Great Britain and her empire, whom danger only united more tensely, made to what eventually became the common cause of so many states and nations. I do this with no desire to make invidious comparisons or rouse purposeless rivalries with our greatest ally, the United States, to whom we owe immeasurable and enduring gratitude. But it is to the combined interest of the English-speaking world that the magnitude of the British war-making effort should be known and realized. Till the arrival in Normandy in the autumn of 1944 of the great mass of the American army, we had always the right to speak at least as an equal, and usually as the predominant partner in every theater of war except the Pacific and the Australasian. And this remains also true, up to the time mentioned, of the aggregation of all divisions in all theaters for any given month. From July 1944, the fighting front of the United States, as represented by divisions in contact with the enemy, became increasingly predominant, and so continued, mounting and triumphant, till the final victory 10 months later. Another comparison which I have made shows that the British and Empire sacrifice in loss of life was even greater than that of our valiant ally. The British total dead and missing presumed dead of the armed forces amounted to 303,240, to which should be added over 109,000 from the Dominions, India, and the colonies, a total of over 412,240. This figure does not include 60,500 civilians killed in the air raids on the United Kingdom, nor the losses of our merchant navy and fishermen, which amounted to about 30,000. Against this figure, the United States mourn the deaths in the Army and Air Force, the Navy, Marines, and Coast Guard of 322,188. On the seas, the United States naturally bore almost the entire weight of the war in the Pacific, and the decisive battles which they fought near Midway Island, at Guadalcanal, and in the Coral Sea in 1942 gained for them the whole initiative in the vast ocean domain, and opened to them the assault of all the Japanese conquests, and eventually of Japan herself. The American Navy could not at the same time carry the main burden in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean. Here again, it is a duty to set down the facts. Out of 781 German and 85 Italian U-boats destroyed in the European theater, the Atlantic and Indian Oceans, 594 were accounted for by British sea and air forces, who also disposed of all the German battleships, cruisers, and destroyers, besides destroying or capturing the whole Italian fleet. In the air, superb efforts were made by the United States to come into action. But up till the end of 1943, the British discharge of bombs upon Germany had in the aggregate exceeded by 8 tons to 1 those cast from American machines by day or night. And it was only in the spring of 1944 that the preponderance of discharge was achieved by the United States. It must be remembered that our munitions effort from the beginning of Lend-Lease in January 1941 was increased by over one-fifth through the generosity of the United States. With the materials and weapons which they gave us, we were actually able to wage war as if we were a nation of 58 millions instead of 48. This is all set down not to claim undue credit, but to establish on a footing capable of commanding fair-minded respect the intense output in every form of war activity of the people of this small island, upon whom, in the crisis of the world's history, the brunt fell. My experiences in those first days were peculiar. One lived with the battle upon which all thoughts were centered and about which nothing could be done. All the time, there was the government to form, and the gentlemen to see, and the party balances to be adjusted. In Clement Attlee, I had a colleague of war experience long versed in the House of Commons. Our only differences in outlook were about socialism, but these were swamped by a war soon to involve the almost complete subordination of the individual to the state. We worked together with perfect ease and confidence during the whole period of the government. Sir Archibald Sinclair, as official leader of the Liberal Party, found it embarrassing to accept the office of Air Minister, because his followers felt he should instead have a seat in the War Cabinet. But this ran contrary to the principle of a small War Cabinet. And I therefore proposed that he should join the War Cabinet when any matter affecting fundamental political issues or party union was involved. Mr. Ernest Bevin, with whom I had made acquaintance at the beginning of the war, in trying to mitigate the severe Admiralty demands for trawlers, had to consult the Transport and General Workers' Union, of which he was secretary, before he could join the team in the most important office of Minister of Labour. This took 2 or 3 days, but it was worth it. The Union, the largest of all in Britain, said unanimously that he was to do it, and stuck solid for 5 years, till we won. The greatest difficulty was with Lord Beaverbrook. I believed he had services to render of a very high quality. I had resolved, as the result of my experiences in the previous war, to remove the supply and design of aircraft from the Air Ministry, and I wished him to become the Minister of Aircraft Production. He seemed at first reluctant to undertake the task, and of course the Air Ministry did not like having their supply branch separated from them. There were other resistances to his appointment. I felt sure, however, that our life depended upon the flow of new aircraft. I needed his vital and vibrant energy, and I persisted in my view. In deference to prevailing opinions expressed in Parliament and the press, it was necessary that the War Cabinet should be small. I therefore began by having only 5 members, of whom one only, the Foreign Secretary, had a department. These were naturally the leading party politicians of the day. I am a strong believer in transacting official business by the written word. No doubt, surveyed in the aftertime, much that is set down from hour to hour under the impact of events may be lacking in proportion or may not come true. I am willing to take my chance of that. It is always better, except in the hierarchy of military discipline, to express opinions and wishes rather than to give orders. Still, written directives coming personally from the lawfully constituted head of the government and minister specially charged with defense counted to such an extent that, though not expressed as orders, they very often found their fruition in action. To make sure that my name was not used loosely, I issued during the crisis of July the following minute. Let it be very clearly understood that all directions emanating from me are made in writing, or should be immediately afterwards confirmed in writing, and that I do not accept any responsibility for matters relating to national defense on which I am alleged to have given decisions, unless they are recorded in writing. When I woke about 8 a.m., I read all the telegrams, and from my bed dictated a continuous flow of minutes and directives to the departments and to the chiefs of staff committee. These were typed in relays as they were done, and handed at once to General Ismay, Deputy Secretary to the War Cabinet, and my representative on the Chiefs of Staff Committee, who came to see me early each morning. Thus, he usually had a good deal in writing to bring before the Chiefs of Staff Committee when they met at 10:30. They gave all consideration to my views at the same time as they discussed the general situation. Thus, between 3 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon, unless there were some difficulties between us requiring further consultation, there was ready a whole series of orders and telegrams sent by me or by the chiefs of staff and agreed between us, usually giving all the decisions immediately required. In total war, it is quite impossible to draw any precise line between military and non-military problems. That no such friction occurred between the military staff and the War Cabinet staff was due primarily to the personality of Sir Edward Bridges, Secretary to the War Cabinet. Not only was this son of a former poet laureate an extremely competent and tireless worker, but he was also a man of exceptional force, ability, and personal charm, without a trace of jealousy in his nature.